Let's move on to agenda paper 2, extractives. We have just under an hour for this session, and I think we have 3 questions in total. So did you want to kind of go through the slides and then ask questions? Is that how you prefer to do it?
Yep. So good morning, everyone. We are really eager to hear from you on this topic, so I'm just going to dive straight into the slides. So looking first at slide 3, we are in the process of gathering information to help the board understand the problems users face when using financial statements of entities operating within the extractives industry. The feedback we get today will also be used to help the board define the scope of this research project. So slide 5 details the questions that we have for the committee. However, before we hear from you, I'll just provide an update on the current status of the project and also refresh your memory on what the 2010 discussion paper addressed. So moving on to slide 7-9, IFRS 6 currently allows diversity in the recognition and measurement of transactions, other events and conditions in relation to the exploration for and evaluation of minerals and resources. Consequently, the accounting policies applied can vary quite a bit from entity to entity, and it can affect primary users' understanding of the financial statements. Slide 9 does provide some examples of accounting policies that are currently being applied using IFRS 6. So the research project became active in 2018, and the board is currently gathering evidence to help it decide whether to start a project to develop proposals to replace IFRS 6 or amend it. As part of this, the board is considering feedback from the 2010 discussion paper and has asked those national standard setters that contributed to the discussion paper to inform the board of any significant developments since its publication. So feedback from those national standard setters has been summarised in slides 14-19. Slide 10 identifies the key themes of feedback from that discussion paper. The discussion paper outlined the project team's views on a broad range of topics, which included what the scope of a project on extractive activities should be, including the definitions of reserves and resources in an IFRS standard, asset recognition and unit of account, asset measurement and impairment, and disclosure, which included proposals to disclose payments to governments. In particular, although respondents to the discussion paper generally supported the board having a project on extractive activities, we had a lot of mixed views on what the scope of such a project should be and whether consistent accounting and disclosure model should apply to both mining and oil and gas industries. The project team were also of the view that the mineral reserve and resource definitions established by CRISCO and oil and gas reserve and resource definitions established in PRMS should be used in an IFRS for extractive activities. So while respondents broadly supported defining reserve and resource in an IFRS, there were concerns about the feasibility of incorporating a third-party reserve and resource classification system into an IFRS standard. The discussion paper also proposed that legal rights, such as exploration rights or extraction rights, should form the basis of an asset, and that information obtained from subsequent exploration and evaluation activities and development works undertaken would be treated as enhancements of those legal rights. Most respondents did support the initial asset recognition model, but generally did not agree that subsequent activities would always enhance the legal right and should always be recognised as an asset. The project team also recommended that these legal rights assets should be measured at historical cost as opposed to fair value. The majority of respondents supported historical cost as the measurement basis, however, requested that the board clarify further the application of depreciation or amortization to such assets and how an entity might determine what the unit of account for such an asset would be. The project team also discussed testing exploration properties for impairment. In particular, the discussion paper outlined an approach that would see those legal rights assets not being tested for impairment in accordance with IAS 36. Instead, those assets would be written down to their recoverable amounts in those cases where management actually has enough information to make the assessment. Most respondents disagreed that an exception to the impairment model in IAS 36 should be permitted for exploration properties. Finally, the discussion paper also looked at disclosure. In particular, the project team identified potential disclosure objectives and a detailed list of types of information that would be required to be disclosed in order to meet those objectives. Although respondents agreed that additional disclosures would be useful, they were concerned with the volume of disclosures being proposed, and the types of information that the project team wanted disclosed as well. These respondents also expressed concern about the audit implication of additional disclosures. Slide 12 details the proposed next steps on this project. In order to help the board define the scope of this project, we are seeking feedback from CMAQ to better understand the issues that users of extractive industry financial statements face. So our questions for the committee are listed on slide 5. In order to make the most of our time, we will not stop to discuss each question. Rather, we would appreciate hearing all of your comments at once. And with that, I would like to turn over to the committee for their feedback. Thank you.
Just one thing briefly to add for me. I mean, I think it's obvious, but clearly this is a critical stage of the project in terms of scoping out what the problem statement is. If we don't get that right at the beginning, there's a danger that, you know, a lot of resource and time gets pointed in the wrong direction, and this is where we really need user help.
Thank you. So I guess I hope you don't regret your comment about getting all comments at once, but let's see how we go, knowing this committee, but let's see how we go. So I don't have any questions at the moment because these are kind of slightly outside my area of direct expertise, but questions from the floor? Comments?
Is it just worth reminding particularly new members how we operate in terms of putting, fantastic, if you want to speak, yes, just put up your card.
Yeah, just wondering, when you're comparing oil and gas and the mining industry, and I think there's always some concerns about, you know, looking too narrowly at, you know, just one sector and treating it as an island. So, I mean, to what extent are you cross-referencing other sectors? So, for example, to what extent are you comparing this to things like pharmaceutical R&D, where you've got some of the same risk-reward considerations? Or any other, like any other, are you generally concerned that, you know, this could in some way spill over into other sectors?
So certainly, as part of the scoping question, there will be a consideration of the example that you give, for example, pharmaceuticals, because some of the feedback on the scoping that we got on the discussion paper was around these activities have similar characteristics to some other activities in other industries. And there was some feedback asking the question, why should these activities be treated any differently to other similar activities? And R&D in the pharmaceutical industry was the one that was often quoted. And so as part of that scoping discussion and scoping question, that will be something that the board will need to consider. If there is a desire to have a project on this particular activity, the board will need to think about, is there a crossover to some of the other similar type of activities, and why is this particular activity, why should the focus be on this particular activity? And that's definitely a question that will be asked as part of the scoping.
I'm going to go to Paul and then Deirdre.
So it seems to me that the areas that you identify from arising from the 2010 discussion paper are right and still valid. I think there's an area which has emerged particularly strongly over the last decade that I don't think came up then, but I think needs to be in some way in scope, and that's the issue of climate change and its implications, I think, particularly for reserves, resources, and that impairment question. There are a number of resources that are currently underground that perhaps should stay underground, and there are some very big questions around whether companies are actively thinking about the valuations of those assets with a mind to whether they have the useful life that perhaps they do have in the accounts. And I think this is an opportunity for the board to really think about that and perhaps encourage some different thought. It may be that it's more of a question for the securities regulators and the way in which the standards are applied, but I simply think it has to be on the board's agenda if you're opening up this area.
If I could, would it? I guess a question I have for you is: we are seeing an increasing trend towards integrated reporting. Would this, address your concern, or would you like to see the board be more active in incorporating climate change reporting into the standards themselves?
I think that we miss a trick if this is only addressed in the narrative reporting. I think, the simple fact is, there are some pretty big assumptions in the back end of the accounts that, for example, that coal mines will have a 25-year life. That doesn't seem entirely consistent with the Paris Agreement. And whether or not the Paris Agreement will be where the world ends up, doesn't seem likely that coal mines will genuinely have a 25-year life. And while that still happens in the back end of the accounts, whatever is set up in the front end, we're not joining the dots. So, and I think we need to move towards joining the dots.
Okay. Osmond, do you mind if I just respond to that also? Because I just wanted to flag, actually, there's a very good piece which has been put together jointly by the Australian Accounting Standards Board and the Australian Assurance Board that looks at how our existing standards can be applied to the climate change. And I'm happy to circulate that. I think often it's felt that we're silent on this, but that's not the case. It's expressed in terms of Australian accounting standards, so the numbers of the standards don't look quite right, and we're considering whether we can repurpose that, so to put it into IFRS language. And in fact, that's been discussed at our meeting with standard setters in a couple of weeks' time.
I've seen that, and I think it's a very good bit of work, and I think seeing that adopted more internationally would be very welcome.
Just to say, Goro and Rosemary, if you want to speak, maybe if you just indicate, and then we'll add your name to the list as well. Let's move on then to Deirdre.
Thank you. Obviously, this isn't an area of expertise, given I'm typically financial, but I did ask my colleagues who are active in this area, so I'm actually going to largely read out their feedback. It's very handy to be able to send them the presentation. So I suppose the first question first point they wanted to make was regards to reserve and resource comparability. They find it very difficult at the moment. There is no comparability. They didn't have, a light bulb moment as to how to simplify it. Obviously, they'd prefer a much more uniform definition It did point to the 10K that you get for oil companies, that there seems to be some sort of standardisation there, and questioned whether or not that might be useful for the board to consider, and whether or not that could be brought into the standards here. And there was also a comment made with regards to possibly liaising with the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board. So I suppose that brings it back to the environmental issue. Perhaps they have some insights, again, with regards to how to standardise the disclosure here with reserves to reserve and resource comparability. The next big area for them was accounting for subsidiaries, associates and joint ventures. These tend to be significant line items for these type of this sector. And again, given the current accounting standards, often they can just be one line on the financial statements, and there's no detailed disclosure in terms of earnings and balance sheet, et cetera, for these items. So there was a question raised within the group as to whether or not there should be a separate standard just for this sector, given the materiality of these line items. But in general, definitely there needs to be greater disclosure. I suppose the pushback may be from the if a separate accounting standard isn't possible, you could always have a materiality clause. So it would be the sum of the JVs and the associates, not the individual line items, because obviously on an individual basis they may be still quite small, but the sum could be substantial, and that's where they run into issues. The next item they pointed out was with regards to the definition of line items on the financial statements, and they were particularly pointing to royalties and streaming agreements. These, my understanding from what they were explaining to me, are like a charge on the revenue line items from these extractive industries, but they're actually not shown as an adjustment to the revenue line. They're often treated as a finance item, whereas they would argue it should be an adjustment. It should be an adjustment to sales or revenue, because it is a first claim on any of the revenue that is coming out of the mines. And then the final comment was with regards to the exploration and the evaluation accounting policies. And here, again, they didn't have any light bulb moments as to how to provide the disclosure, but they seem to run into challenges in just reconciling the disclosure to the line items on the financial statements. So if the disclosure could even be simplified, or a little table provided which would improve the transparency, so it was easier for users to identify the amount that has been expensed during the year, the amount that was written off, and the amount that was capitalised, that would be a big step forward, just to enable that reconciliation between the financial statements and those line item disclosures. And that was their feedback.
Thanks, Deirdre. I have next on the list is Salim.
Thank you. I think the analogy to the farm industry and R&D is kind of quite pertinent on this topic. I mean, we make a lot of economic adjustments, and one of those adjustments is capitalising R&D, because every spend in R&D, whatever that is, you know, is an investment in the future profitability of a company. And the same applies with this sector when you look at exploration costs, because otherwise you're return on capital employed is going to be overstated on that basis. So what we typically do, and this really answers the kind of the adjustments question, is to capitalise all of those costs on balance sheet, so then companies are held accountable for that. So effectively what we're doing is removing the diversity in the accounting policy. And I think going on to Deirdre's point there, I mean, you know, that's our approach, but again, if there was clearer disclosure about what was written off, what was actually expensed, just let the users adjust it accordingly on that sense. And that, I mean, we've obviously got a mining team. I'm not an expert in that sector, but again, a lot of the value when you look at valuation is off balance sheet. You know, so again, there's perhaps a limitation to how users are using financials in that sense. So I don't know if that's helpful. We're basically reversing out whatever's been reported. That's what we do with R&D.
When you say off balance sheet, do you mean the information is outside the financial statements?
Correct, which is valued by investors, right? That's what they're looking at as key metrics. It's similar to the drugs industry, where you've got, you know, drugs, you're looking at different phases, and that's what investors are paying for. And a lot of value is attributed to that. So,
thanks, Salim. So we've got Paolo and then Marietta.
Well, coming from Brazil, as you can imagine, I think that we have very specific concerns about this issue in terms of how the company is dealing with environmental risks, prevention of environmental risks, and what kind of investment is being made in that area. And, of course, I mean, how the company sees putting everything back together in terms of closure and rehab of mining sites, which might be a very significant expense. In many cases, I mean, if you see, as we have in our country, huge, enormous, open pit mines, in some cases more than 1 mile across, I mean, putting everything together will be extremely expensive. So trying to see, even if you take into account all international and well-deserved concerns about them and how much the company is spending trying to avoid catastrophic events as we have had in our country.
Yeah, so I'll just walk you through all of the gating factors in terms of the comparison to pharmaceutical R&D. So, I mean, the way this is being handled in the healthcare sector is that only R&D on things like medtech or diagnostics, where you kind of know that just by putting in a certain amount of time and resource, you will eventually get it right, can actually be capitalized. And even that is treated quite cautiously normally. And, you know, a lot of times they only capitalize a certain proportion of the R&D. For pharmaceuticals, any R&D that you incur in-house is actually expensed straight through the P&L. And that's being done even in cases where, you know, based on our understanding of biology nowadays, it's actually quite straightforward. So if you have a very specific cancer mutation or very specific enzyme that's missing and you're just replacing that, you basically know that the drug can't really fail based on efficacy, but you still don't know. I mean, that could be a safety issue. You know, there might be something better out there, and, you know, the FDA might not approve it. So I actually kind of agree with that approach to actually just expense it all through the P&L and treat it as a sunk cost, really. And the job of the analyst is then to figure out what is the probability that something comes out of it in the future. And I think if we ever try to, you know, sort of like treat some pharmaceutical R&D spend as being somewhat more predictable in terms of the outcome, there would be a hell of a lot of confusion as to which projects have gone onto the balance sheet, which projects have gone through the P&L. So I think that that approach is actually quite good. Where I think, you know, there is a little bit of controversy is with externally acquired assets, because those are actually capitalized and then either impaired when they're killed or amortized when the product starts its useful life. So I think the issue a lot of investors have with it is that by, you know, deciding whether to develop something in-house or, you know, in-license it, you can actually affect the timing that you're showing the P&L expense, which is quite important because in pharma, a lot of investors are very, very hung up on margins, and there's a lot of pressure on management to get the margins up and have the same margin structure as the competition. But with that caveat, I mean, to me, it sounds quite consistent the way externally acquired assets are treated in pharma with the way that, you know, the assets, the legal rights are acquired in the extractive industry, put on the balance sheet and, you know, impaired, you know, if you think that nothing is going to come out of it, and also the incremental spend that the pharma company then puts into it in the course of the clinical trials, that also gets expensed through the P&L, and that again seems quite consistent to me, and I don't think we should really sacrifice any of that consistency. The other thing that I just wanted to point out is that in the pharmaceutical industry, you tend to know how long it takes you to get an answer. So depending on the stage of the clinical trials you're conducting, it's somewhere between, you know, 6 months or, you know, for a full phase three trial, maybe 3 years from start to actual readout. And I think that's also something that you should consider and benchmark against the extractives industry. I've never really looked at extractives, but my concern would be that it can actually be quite hard to get something out of the ground. It can take quite long to figure out how to do it and to get the financing in place and to decide if you really want to do it. And I think there is a chance, you know, I mean, it's been mentioned that, you know, we have all the climate change issues and renewables coming up. So I think it might be even harder than in pharmaceuticals to say what it will actually be worth as and when you get it out of the ground, whereas in pharma you tend to, you know, if suddenly there is a much better competitive product cropping up, then, you know, you just kill your project for commercial reasons immediately, and it's not that straightforward in the extractive industry. So those are just some points that I'd like to take into account.
Thanks, Marietta. So let's go now to Goro.
After Goro, I have one now.
Go ahead, Goro.
I have to put my hand up. Yeah.
Goro, we can't hear you yet. We still can't hear you.
Can't hear you.
Here we go to Rosemary, because we can't hear her.
Some end is on mute.
Yes, yep. We can hear you. Go ahead.
Do you hear?
Yes.
Can you hear?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that this is an extremely industry-specific agenda, and the it is my regret to say, but the we are not, you know, that the we may not be in a kind of relevant users of information of this. Of course, you know that I really appreciate that comment from Salim and the Marietta as you know, the very professional insights on the, you know, research and development. But there's still, I believe this is extremely industry specific, and so that the I believe that the board can take a similar approach with the management commentary, that I believe that the board formed that the management commentary consultative group. And I think that as Nick said, that the scoping is a very, I guess that the scoping is extremely important for this this project, particularly at this time of the juncture. So that I believe that it might be a very good idea for the board to form some kind of expert group or task force to discuss the expert group, which consists of the members from the oil and mining industries and the sectors analysts, and probably that the ESG specialists who are really concerning about climate issues like Paul and Paolo suggested. So that I think that there are so many kind of politically, I guess from that these slides, that there are so many politically sensitive issues, and so that not only you have to consult that not only the financial statement users, but also that the industry groups and the preparers, and maybe that the regulators from the jurisdictions where these extractive industries are very significant to the economy, like Brazil or Australia. So I believe that you should form such kind of a consultative body and to hear their voices at the same time. Thank you.
Thanks, Goro. Just going to move around the order a little bit, because I think, Paolo, you wanted to respond to something that was said a little bit.
Is that just in your comment?
I'm going to jump, if I may, to Rosemary. Go ahead, Rosemary.
Hello, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Good morning, everyone, and again, sorry I couldn't be there. I mean, a lot of the, like Dietrich, I don't invest in this space, so I did reach out to a couple of folks that have in the past, and we'll provide some comments, and some of it will be repetitive to what you've already heard. Overall, their comment was that oil and gas companies, and this is more just from, you know, for the staff, we're looking at companies or industries that are more, that have better information than others, their experience was that in oil and gas, the information is much better than in mining companies. And of course, there's a huge discrepancy in the quality of information, some providing a lot of geological information, detailed costing, both operating and capital, and of course, others far less. They look at the financials, and when your session with other information they need, they look at filing from CEDAR, 3-101, technical reports, there's a management filing from the website. In terms of the detailed reserve and cost of the reserves and so on, I think a lot of that's already been touched on, so I probably won't repeat that. They talked about the environmental issues, as Paolo mentioned, the concern. One of the areas that I hadn't thought of at all was just the discussion of water. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, good. I'm hearing a lot of background noise. Discussion of water availability. They thought that that should be included in the extractive industries because of the availability and cost of water resources going forward. They also talked about the whole environmental risk reclamation and how we can't follow that. So a lot of, you know, when you're taking stuff out of the ground, there's a lot of, as somebody already mentioned, a lot of future issues, and so trying to capture some of those costs in the current financial statement makes the information or make the statement a lot more informative. And just quickly going through some of my notes, we're not sure if it's already been said. Yeah, the other comment they made, and again, this is something that the staff, more for the staff, and that, you know, as they become more extractive industries, more technically complex, you know, really just being aware of the information and protecting. So when you look at, for example, metals used for lithium batteries and so on, getting a better understanding of the material itself, which is very important in comparing, you know, one company to another. We also, of course, identified, you know, political risk and so on, and how they adjust their evaluation, you know, depending on political risk. I think that's understood. I think, just trying to go through this, I think that's all. I mean, they touched on a lot of the comments that were already made out at the end.
Great. Thanks, Deirdre.
Rosemary.
Sorry, I do apologise. Thanks, Rosemary. I need some more coffee, clearly. So we've got quite a few people on the list. Let's move on then to Philip and then Jeremy.
Okay, thank you. This is going to be quite repetitive because I've undertaken very much similar exercise to Deirdre and Rosemary and got very similar feedback. Reserves were one of the key things that were mentioned. I also got the comment that the oil and gas companies are generally better than the miners, which is quite interesting. And just in the miners, maybe the only other thing that I can add was one thing that the Moody's analysts find quite difficult to determine, where they've got a miner which is involved in a number of different metals. What they would like to determine is the cost for each metal and the break-even point for each metal, the profitability of each metal. Mm. And they struggle quite a lot to do that at the moment. So that's maybe something that could be, it's quite detailed, but factored into the disclosures.
Fantastic. Thanks, Philip. Jeremy?
Just more following on, I also asked the oil and gas analyst practically how do they look at the exploration, and there was a lot of reliance on third-party valuation reports. So rather than looking at the exploration expenditure in the accounts, they went to third-party sources looking at NPV projections and probabilities there. So that was their kind of first point. In terms of the scope of the project, I think at least for the integrator, I think the CapEx, I think, should maybe look maybe perhaps together with exploration, because it's often an order of magnitude larger than exploration expenditure. And from my kind of slight distant perspective, one of the major questions for the valuation is the maintenance CapEx. How can we approach looking at that? The information to help us assess maintenance CapEx, by which I mean how much do you have to spend to maintain productive output, ideally at a specific oil price or commodity price, and have that shown in the accounts would be very helpful.
Thank you, Jeremy. Paolo, did you want to?
Yeah, just a quick point. Once more, to our national experience. I think there is no industry as affected as by economic cycles.
Here's what I found on the web for foreign national.
Siri has also an opinion. the point there is, let's assume, let's make it simple. You buy a reserve, oil reserve or a mining reserve, as a result of an economic cycle, and it should remain in the ground, not for environmental reasons, but as a result of extraction costs. You have shale and you have the Chinese economic cycle. All of a sudden, you are no longer very rich, as happened in Brazil. And then what do? You impair your cost, knowing that this thing may change in a couple of years. And after that, quote unquote, heretically, you disimpair that because you're rich again. It's not a matter of manufacturing videotapes, but it's something that will change or could change dramatically in a couple of years. How do you deal with impairment and quote unquote disimpairment? Do you impair your reserves? How do you deal with that? Telling investors that, look, I'm no longer rich, but I could be rich again in a couple of years. We're dealing with that with our pre-salt reserves.
Thanks, Paolo. Let's move on then to Bertrand and then Glenn.
Yes, so some comments. I'm not expert in this industry, but by discussing with other analysts, there is some issue. One is with regard to the evaluation of resources and reserves, for example, on which price are they based. So to have a better understanding of the evaluation of these resources and reserves would be nice. And also there are some questions about a better understanding of the business by geographical area, because the conditions are not the same depending on the areas. This would also be nice.
Okay. Glenn?
So I have, I am quite a big investor in this particular area, in both mining and in oil. There is a big difference between the standard reporting, only because the oil industry is so much more mature than the mining industry. And the template that's used in the oil industry is not bad. So we have the reserve measurement, 1P, 2P, 3P reserves. The SEC requires disclosure of the 2P reserves, and that's the sort of standard benchmark for reserve valuation. That's quite a good idea for any scarce resource, to be honest. So, copper and indium and rhodium and all that kind of stuff that people, some of these are very scarce now. Indium, which is the stuff that's used that makes the screens of the mobile phone sensitive, there's only about 10 years left of it. We extract about 10 kilos a year. That's all. It's very, very rare, but we've never been able to find an estimate of the reserves of the companies that mine it. And that would be really interesting to know, because firstly, focus the mind of investors on what are we going to do, because we can't reclaim it because it's used in such small amounts. And secondly, what's the alternatives? And that will focus everybody on that kind of strategic decision making about what value you put on it. So that's the question of measurement of reserves. And Paolo's absolutely right. The reserves are a question of a whole bunch of economic considerations to do with, for ordinary metals, for and extractive industries, for economic cycles, credit cycles, and for other things, so more secular things. But the life cycle of these things is not the life cycle of an economic cycle. The life cycle of these things is 25 years or 30 years. And the oil companies basically tend to measure through the cycle, using through the cycle discount rates. And that's not, investors are kind of used to that. So you very rarely find oil companies trading at reserve, because everybody knows it's a question of where you are in relation to the cycle. So that's not a bad way of proceeding, I think. But it will be helpful to understand this by major metal, or at least to understand what categories of metal or extractive product, if you like, the miners are really exposed to, because we all know, you know, copper, yeah, very important, and it's very important to the economics, a very cyclical product, but it might not be where the juice is, it might not be where the value added is. And we know that coal might be very cheap, but, you know, and it might be at some points uneconomic, but there's a lot of value in it because of volume. We kind of like to understand that kind of thing about the mines. And then there's a second side of this. So one of the problems that people have, so there are consultancies that do it for miners as well as the oil companies. I think that the oil company reserves are publicly available. So you can subscribe to Wood Mackenzie or to Herald, and you can get the reserve estimates. They are NPV calculations. I mean, they're not. You know, it's not more sophisticated than that. They're making assessments of what is economically usable at any given point, given a whole bunch of economic assumptions, and the most important of which is their discount rate. But you get the weird phenomenon, which kind of begs the question, which is something kind of everybody needs to think about for the oil companies as well as for the miners, that the companies tend to trade the assets based on their reserve estimates. But the companies trade on a big discount to reserve estimates, the listed companies. So it's almost like you buy an asset for 100 and it's only worth 70 after you've bought it. And this has been going on for about 35 years, 40 years, where, you know, every time an oil company buys an asset from another oil company, they pay 100 and investors immediately value it at 70. And so that's the problem. And then the other side of it, so a bunch of investors are, you know, focused on the flows in the industry as opposed to the asset side of the industry. And this is actually really, really important for some of the legacy businesses. So if you think that oil is legacy, if you think that coal is legacy, the people that get interested in the legacy business are the ones who want the dividends, who basically say, stop the capex, just pay out the dividends and run the business down over time. And that's, you know, perfectly good strategy. I think we've more or less kind of buttoned that down, because that's the normal rules of all of this. The big issue there is the matching of what the reserve estimate was versus what you're putting in your costs at any given point in time. Are you using marginal cost or using the historic book cost? And then as an investor, you'd kind of want to know the difference between those two, because the marginal cost tells you something economic. But you'd need to kind of do something about the difference between the economic cost at any given point in time and the historical cost. Those are the kind of issues. More or less, I mean, if you listen to some of the very big fund managers in this space, they do say quite clearly they do not understand miners. Very clearly. So you might listen to, for example, Mark Barnett, who manages a fund that I'm the chairman of at Invesco Perpetual. He's done a whole video on how he avoids the sector, because it's very difficult to understand. But he has invested in oil and gas, for example.
Thanks, Glenn. I think, Glenn, in the past, I think you've been quite taken to some of your comments on very practical approach to saying there's information out there, it's just not in the accounts, and that's absolutely fine. It's up to investors to make the view. I guess, would it be right to say that you might take that view for oil and gas companies, but not for miners? So miners, the kind of external third-party information, additional voluntary disclosures or whatever,
yes,
isn't...
I really think that's right, because I think the thing about the oil companies is that, you know, the level of governance and scrutiny is so great that we've kind of more or less got all the information, and we've got consultancies crawling over them, and everybody knows, you know, the big difficulties are, for example, what the oil company is up to in Nigeria or in Angola or something like that. But we kind of know that now because the consultants. But what the miners are up to in, you know, Myanmar or the Congo, I think that's much, much more vague, and, you know, people make very scary films about that kind of stuff. But it'd be quite useful to have some information about that that isn't, you know, well, it's independent at least.
Thank you. Mitch?
A couple of questions, actually, and that last comment is a good segue to one of my questions, which is, are you in this, the urgency of this review, is it that there is inconsistencies, or is it manipulation in the sense that there is a disconnect between what's being reported and reality. I mean, clearly there is. That's one question. So is it inconsistency, or have you seen examples of just outright sort of abuse that has elevated the urgency? And related to that, sort of again, segue from previous comments, is there a difference between DM and VM, DM and EM in oil and then in the mining? Maybe it's that some of those miners are buried in JVs or shared entities. And you know, there's a need to unlock that.
I mean, certainly the objective of the project is to determine at the moment whether there's a need to replace and IFRS 6, which was seen to be, it was a temporary standard that was put in place for exploration and evaluation expenditure. And so that's the starting focus of the project as to, well, what do we need to do with IFRS 6? But as part of this scoping question, the question we'll be asking the board is, how wide should the scope of that be, and should we go beyond what's in the scope of IFRS 6? And what we're trying to establish through some of the research that we're doing, but also through outreach like this today, is there a problem with inconsistency in terms of IFRS 6? As is shown in the slide deck, there are a number of different accounting policies that companies can adopt for their exploration and evaluation expenditure. And part of what we're trying to establish is, does the inconsistency that creates a problem for users? And there was one comment today regarding that is a problem. But also wider than that, and again, we've heard that comment today. We've heard, I think, a lot of people say that reserve and resource information is really important, but we've also heard comments that actually that's not always available, or where it is available, there is some inconsistency about that information. So I think that's one of the focuses of the project, and will be the question that the board will need to answer when it determines the scope as to, well, how wide do we call this project? But part of what will influence that decision is the discussion like we're having today, and hopefully we'll have also with other users and other stakeholders around the problem of inconsistency and does it cause a problem? You'll have to excuse my naivety here. You might have to explain what you mean by DM and EM before I can...
It's developed in emerging markets.
Oh, right, OK. And is there a difference between... Well, again, I guess, and that might play into the reserve and resource information again in terms of what is the availability... Is there a difference in availability of some of the information that users, for example, find really important between developed and emerging markets? And because there are some well-established reserve classification systems in developed markets, and it's part of what I think we will need to consider is, but is that available everywhere for all markets? And is there a need to address that issue? And that's what the board will need to consider.
Paolo, did you have...
No, I'm sorry.
Hi. Okay. One of the things we're interested in is your ideas about, in relation to the resources and reserves disclosure. We know that there's lots of requirements around the world that companies follow, and we've had some comments this morning about the better and worse sides of that disclosure. And one of the things that we'll have to think about is the extent to which we can cross-reference outside the standards to those existing already guidelines and requirements. So I don't know if anyone's got any thoughts on that aspect.
someone will need to own the information, so you can't just cross-reference to a third party. You know, someone's got to take responsibility for the truth is the wrong word, but for the quality of the information. And I think that, you know, if you're just pointing to somebody else, you're creating a liability and a risk for that third party, or an expectation for that third party, which maybe he hasn't or she hasn't or they haven't agreed to.
But you're just talking about cross-referencing to other standards rather than to disclosures, is that right?
Well, a lot of the disclosures exist outside the financial statements, and we know that investors are using those disclosures in some way. So this question of whether it we want to just continue to make use of systems of making disclosure that already exist and are already in a lot of ways recognised and credited. Would it make any sense to create new disclosure requirements within a standard?
Yeah.
There'd be a lot of people who would push back against that.
And I think I'd share that view personally, that reinventing the wheel doesn't seem a particularly worthwhile activity. Finding ways to use information that's already out there or incorporate standards that are already out there seems a much more sensible way forward.
Jeremy?
Well, just maybe an observation just on the consistency point. I think an odd thing about the oil and, especially oil and gas, it seems as though exploration and capex follows the oil price. It's a very volatile variable to follow. So it means that if you're capitalising and amortising exploration expenditure, in effect, your amortisation charge is embedding a weighted average oil price of the past, and you're comparing that to typically the revenues, which is the prevailing oil price. So there's some inconsistency coming there, and that's perhaps a distinction between maybe on the R&D for pharmaceuticals, where the cost is largely independent of the revenue line, the eventual revenue line. So just if there's some way of, again, surfacing that inconsistency, that would be helpful.
I'm going to go to Marietta and then...
I have a quick question, and I apologize if this is somewhat naive, but I mean, to what extent is there actually an audit on the quality and the quantity of the stuff that's in the ground? Because I appreciate, you know, there's different ways to value it, and there's the economic cycle and so forth, but what if management, you know, kind of lies or overestimates what is in the ground to begin with, if they either, like, I don't know, maybe someone deliberately fudged an essay and they're not even aware of it, or you know, basically the algos they use to estimate, you know, what is in the total land mass based on the work they've done on a small patch, you know, is maybe a little bit too generous. How does that work? I mean, how reliable is the actual information if somebody says, we think there's this much gold or this much oil of this and that greater quality in the land that we own?
I think, unfortunately, what we are seeing now is each jurisdiction appears to have its own resource and reserve classification system, which is subject to its own regulation. So I guess some of the more developed systems do require a competent person to sign off on what's being disclosed in terms of reserves and resources. And there is a list of things that this competent person has had to achieve in their career before they are allowed to sign off on this report. But in saying that, there are other less developed systems that might not be so stringent. So unfortunately, with regards to as to whether that information is actually audited, we can't say whether or not it is at the moment. We're not entirely sure exactly with regards to the extent of governance and control of this information.
Can I chip in here? For most of the companies, they will not start a CapEx project until a geologist has given them an estimate of reserves. And obviously, the reserves will depend, you know, some very extractable reserves, some less extractable, some that are remote, depending on where the price is. So it's a function of price, how much reserves it. So if you imagine Vale in Brazil or Glencore, one of these, they have very competent geologists that give them an idea of what those reserves are. What they disclose is a different matter. That's a question partly of commercial confidence, but it's also a question of what they're forced to by by regulators at the end of it. But there are, you know, there is a whole kind of industry of very competent geologists that make estimates based on prices, which the boards use to decide on CapEx plans. That, I mean, for the big companies that we know of.
But are they sort of like, you know, employees of the company? Or, I mean, are there any sort of like third-party people, are these competent persons you mentioned? Are they sort of regulators or whatever? I mean, I just think, you know, I mean, if a company just wanted to get a higher market valuation or...
Boards. I mean, company like Vale has a bunch of internal geologists, but they also rely upon external consultants.
But we've got to take their word for it. Basically, there's no sort of third-party audit of it. I mean, that was, I mean, that was just from my understanding.
I think that depends on the jurisdiction, to a degree.
There is no four-part audit because, I mean, you cube your own reserves and then you hire someone and then, I mean, so the point there on the same keynote is that at least in large mining companies and large reserves, there are a big distinction between so-called cubed reserves and those inferred, that you assume that should be somewhere down there, but you don't know how much. And that's the big question.
Okay.
Can I just make make an observation and ask a question? I guess throughout the discussion, there has been quite a lot of focus on reserves and resources, and that therefore suggests they are a very important part of the information that users use to assess companies in these industries. And I would say largely all of that information is outside the financial statements, and we've heard concerns about, you know, maybe audit, for example, and also consistency and availability as well. So do CMAC members... therefore, would they think that actually the board should think about trying to standardise reserve and resource disclosures and maybe bring that within an IFRS standard?
So, if I may, it's kind of difficult because determining a standard that would apply to iron ore, copper, and niobium and rare earth at the same time will be extremely difficult. It's so different from...
It seems to me, just listening to some of the comments around the table, is quite insightful. Nick, you mentioned this is kind of the early stage projects, essentially to kind of get the feedback, and somebody talked about, you know, this kind of industry is very specific in having some kind of project group, working group that kind of feeds into that. As a starting point would be quite helpful. With regard to kind of the point you raise about standardized and disclosure, it seems to me that, again, people should disagree if I'm kind of not summarizing appropriately, but it seems to me what people are talking about is the difference between different types of extractive industries, and some are more well-established, working well, and where that isn't the case, maybe there's a case for kind of standardizing disclosures, requiring disclosures, or at least pointing disclosures where there is a required information available. Be a good way forward. I think we had James.
I don't want to interrupt if anyone wanted to answer Tim's question, but this is a slightly different angle. It occurs to me that we're going to discuss 12.15 provisions, contingent liabilities and contingent assets, IS 37. The one thing that hasn't so come up, obviously, but tangentially from what Paolo said and earlier what Paul said, is that if you're going to get some expertise, like there seems to be external expertise in this, it also touches on IAS 37 because of decommissioning costs. Now, I mean, as a financials analyst, I'm faced with decommissioning costs from things that were sold to RMBS, PPI. It takes up a lot of my time, that kind of decommissioning. You know, what's happened with a lot of the open pit mines will have decommissioning. And I was having another discussion. By the way, I can't provide from my house
any feedback on this because it's covered entirely by our US GAP deputy head of research, and he doesn't even want to think about IFRS. the point I'm getting to is that there is a broader issue of all this decommissioning, and if you're going to get any kind of work, it should surely overlap with ISO 7, because it seems more and more this decommissioning issue, even not only for traditional energy-related industries, but think of, we're invested in a lot of these wind farms, and you know perfectly well that we want to sell out sometime before the useful life, because they're not really, especially closed-ended funds, are not really taking into account of the decommissioning of those monstrosities in the middle of the North Sea. So.
Okay, so let's take some final comments. So if anyone has any comments, please put up your card. We've got Philip and then Peter.
Okay. Maybe I can just start with an answer to Tim's question, first of all. And certainly the feedback that I got was yes, that they would like some standard reserve disclosure within the standard. And I appreciate that may be difficult, you know, comparing miners with oil and gas companies, but certainly that was the feedback that I got. I was going to make a slightly different comment just about the differences in accounting policies, just moving slightly away from reserves for a minute. I didn't get much feedback on that, probably because the oil companies that we would look at would all be using successful efforts anyway. But presumably some of the policies we have, the full cost policies we have at the moment, just don't fit within the conceptual framework. Is that correct? Is that part of the reason for looking at?
Well, again, certainly one of the things that we are looking at as staff is the new conceptual framework, because that is a significant change that has happened since the DP was done in 2010, and we're looking at how that might impact some of the findings and feedback in the discussion paper. So that certainly will be part of the process. But again, going back to what I said, this starts with looking at IFRS 6, and it starts with looking at, is there a problem with that diversity, and is there a need for the board to amend or replace IFRS 6, and considering the impact of the differences in accounting policies, full costs, successful efforts, area of interest, or just expensing rather than capitalising, that will be something that needs to be considered. I was going to make a comment actually. There have been some comments on the actual financial statements themselves and some of the information content within that specific to extractive industries and those accounting policies differences. But there's been more of a focus on, I would say, information that's outside the financial statements, such as the reserves and resource information and maybe some other metrics. Again, this is a sort of a general question, but is there? Do you think that is a? Do you think that's reflective of the fact that actually the most important information is outside the financial statements, or do you think that is some? Actually, the information in the financial statements should be improved and can be improved, and actually we do need to focus on that.
For both.
Well, I think it's a point. One would complement the other. I mean, use the third-party valuation services if you want to pay for them to validate or to triangulate against what should be improved information in the financial statements themselves.
Yes.
Right. First of all, let me say I'm not an expert in this industry at all. But it strikes me that when I read what has happened, it uses words like risk, volatility, things like that. When I hear all the comments, it's about there's one asset and the price of another asset, all of a sudden makes this sort of like the dynamics change. Is this where you may think about, in terms of your standardization and financial statement information, is this an area where you might think of pushing the disclosure model towards going away from giving information and point estimates, but rather push more towards the ownership that Glenn was referring to, like show us more what are potential outcomes? I know you take one stance in terms of recognition, but we need to know more about what some of the information is that went into that discussion or that measurement? And more importantly, given that a lot of the information in this space apparently seems to be outside of the financial statements, how do you incorporate some of this thing into actual exercises of coming up with recognition amounts and then follow-up disclosures? So I think it's going beyond point estimates in a balance sheet, if you wish, and then information that relates to that. I think it seems like an area where one could push the disclosures a little bit in a standardized format to give more information along those lines.
And certainly in the discussion paper and some of the disclosure proposals that they had, they were heading in that direction in terms of, you know, clarity on assumptions, but also sensitivity around what would happen if one of these assumptions, like price, for example.
I believe there's some evidence of this already. I need to look up the example, and I will, but I believe there was some evidence in Canadian markets on oil scenario valuations that go in financial statements, and people have actually looked at that and see how they were appreciated by investors. I will find that reference for you.
Thank you.
Glenn?
I agree with that completely. In fact, the sort of standard stuff, the costs and the revenues, etc., that's kind of very, very easy to understand. The difficult bit is understanding where the resource constraint is, what the supply and demand curves look like, and how much supply there really is at what price. And this is obviously quite sensitive for the companies, but really useful information for the investors. That's your tension. At the moment, we're more or less guessing that there's a kind of oligopoly in the industry that basically controls the supply. But if periodically that breaks down and you get more supply than you expect as an investor on stream. So to have some idea, so if you were doing shale oil, for example, if you look at shale oil in the USA, there's so much information that tells you how much oil is available at what oil price. It's not just the companies doing it, that's a whole bunch of third parties providing that information. So the context in which you read the financial statements of a shale oil company is completely different, because they might not tell you everything, but there's so much information around that tells you that at this price it's that, and at that price it's that, and at that price it's that. So you get an idea of the cost curve, and there are other people showing you what the international cost curves look like for Saudi Arabia and for Iran, for Venezuela, for North Sea, Nigeria, etc. So you get a picture. We don't know this picture for copper. We kind of have a good idea that it's something to do with Chile, but, you know, where exactly that's, we don't really have a, so that's the kind of thing that we would like to have. And of course, for some of these, you know, you're basically writing financial statements for one company. Copper, you'd be writing it for Codelco in Chile. That's kind of a difficult thing to do, but that's really what everyone's trying to get their hands around, which is what are the supply and demand curves for this, and at what, how much reserves is there available, and at what price? Because the demand side is stuff that we do every day. You know, it's the estimates we make of growth and GDP and consumption and all that kind of stuff. It's the supply side that's the difficult bit.
Mitch? Just quickly on the consistency side, the question about the consistency, one item that we struggle with is bondholders. If you buy a 25-year bond and reserves are proved 10 years, but probable reserves are X number of years, you know, where, you know, what's, how do you, is it faith-based buying? I mean, not that you don't own a long-term bond for until maturity, but there are some issues around that. I can justify owning something that doesn't have any underlying assets. It's faith-based buying that the probable will convert into proved. So for me, it's a question of, I mean, I don't know if this is the case because it's not an area of expertise, but whether or not there are standards for what is considered proved and what is considered probable. One company's proved might be another, very different from another's and probable. So anything standardization in that might be quite helpful. I think, of course, always in the end, it's going to be principles-based, and so it's always based on what the company wants to declare in that format. I mean, there's always that in all this anyway. But knowing that there is consistency across IFRS reporters, across DM and EM, would be good.
Okay, final comment perhaps from, or question from Anne?
Thank you. Picking up on Peter's point about disclosure, whether there's a way to focus on a disclosure type solution, can I link that back to what Tim has said about the diversity in the policies that are applied to the exploration and evaluation, to the intangible? Because Salim and Marietta said just give the information and then analysts can work from that. And then I also heard the comment that some people give that information in a much a way that could be much improved, a much more clarity, so a table that shows capitalising, expensing, writing off, that sort of thing. So I just wonder if anyone has any comments on the idea that using a type of disclosure solution against the diversity that we know is there, rather than coming against diversity in the way that we might traditionally do it, which is to take it away, to arrive at what is theoretically the best accounting policy, and then say no options. Just wonder if anyone's got any thoughts.
I mean, it's hard to say what's the best accounting policy. I mean, if we're looking to get, I mean, that's ultimately a question for investors to uncover what's the true economics. I think the purpose of the accounting is to maybe shine a light on what the potential economics of the business are and then let investors judge. So just having that clarity, and we're having that issue now with the lease accounting standard in terms of what's been disclosed for the right of use assets, because we're doing our own adjustments in that sense. So just having that clarity in terms of what's expense or what would be the outcome if these were capitalized, and just allowing that to be reversed or adjusted by investors would be of great value. I mean, that's our kind of our house view on how we use financial reporting. I don't know if others disagree or have a different approach to.
We would have a very similar approach. So we would have discussed whether or not it was possible to standardise, and the conclusion was it's not. It's too heterogeneous across the pool of assets. So if we could get clarity around disclosure, then it allows the analyst to determine whatever insight they want to get out of it. But at the moment, the disclosure isn't concise enough or transparent enough, might be the better way of phrasing it, for them to be able to use the information. Okay. Thank you.
Whatever solution you choose, I think investors need to be given all the information to know how the company got to its valuation, or to make up their own mind and to do their own sensitivity. So the worst thing would be just, you know, one standard accounting solution and not knowing how they got there.
It's not about not having disclosures. Is it to the point, right? Because there's a lot of disclosures that happen, but to make the connections, that's the hard bit. So that's why I was, when you brought up standardization, that could be something that could be pushed a little bit, perhaps. Given especially, I mean, again, I'm not an expert in this area, but it seems like there's a lot of information out there, not in the financial statements, but somehow people that run the firm use that information. So wouldn't it be great to know how they do that?
Okay, so we're nearly at the end. I'm going to give the final word to Jeremy.
Just to support Peter's point on the scenario analysis being extremely helpful, and maybe in linking that to the project scope, if the exploration and exploitation and decommissioning, if all of those are somehow considered together in terms of consistency, so if there's an oil price assumption that's consistent across all three areas, that would be helpful as well.
Siobhan, any final comments or questions you'd like to make? Or?
I guess just to summarise what we're hearing, I guess consistent with the 2010 discussion paper feedback, there are a lot of varying views as to what should be done and what should be scoped in by the board. But we have heard some interesting considerations that the board might need to make about incorporating climate change reporting, as well as the standardisation of reserve and resource information. And yes, just to say thank you to everyone for your feedback. It's been incredibly important to hear this from a user perspective.
Fantastic. Thanks, everyone. So we've now got a break until 10:45.